You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And finally, let's talk about Vastamo, which I believe I'm pronouncing correctly. They are a private company that operates 22 locations across Finland and employs some 300 psychotherapists. Now, attackers have demanded 40 Bitcoin, or roughly 450,000 euros, from Vastamo in exchange for not publishing stolen data, but the clinic reportedly did not pay the ransom. Now, an investigation into the incident has been mounted involving the Finnish Cybersecurity Center, the National Bureau of Investigation, and as well, not to mention cybersecurity experts from private sector companies in Finland and around the world. The Office of Data Protection has also been notified, but here's where it gets insane. The clinic did not say when the breach happened, but it said this past Sunday that they received permission from the police to start contacting affected patients on October 21st. So this was a week ago Sunday. The blackmailer had released some of the patient information the morning after. A lot of attackers will do that to say, here's proof I have your data, please pay me. So even if you restore, you don't want this dumped. Now here's where this gets just nuts. Some patients, actual patients, not the business, have started receiving blackmail emails about a week ago Saturday in which the attackers were asking for between 2 to 500 euro for not publishing the patient's stolen data. Apparently more than 200 patients received this email. The clinic and the authorities advised the affected patients not to pay, especially because it can't be confirmed that the attacker and the sender of the email are the same person. And therefore, there is no guarantee that paying will result in the information not getting released, meaning your very personal information is there because the stolen data, according to the reporting, contains personal and health information, including therapist session notes, dates of visits, care plans, management goals, and statements. But it does not include video sessions, as Vastamo apparently does not record things. That is obviously a huge, huge issue. People go to therapists to talk about some of their most intimate problems, the most intimate details of their lives, and to have that dumped out onto the dark web or to be threatened with that, that has got to be very triggering. It's got to be very problematic. It's got to just basically cause anxiety in a whole bunch of people that probably already have a whole lot of anxiety. So that is a huge, huge problem. And hopefully this issue will go away and none of these patients will be affected. But at this point, that's probably too late and that's unfortunate. And so those were your breaches of the week. And wow, I mean, talk about insane, but we got to move on.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
And this week's deep dive, I think, is going to actually be a little special. Let's call it a little special. As I'm sitting here, the very first time anybody is hearing this as it's going out on the air is actually the day before the election, November 2nd of 2020. And so as I sit here and talk about this, you are probably going to hear this either on election day or past election day, for those of you that didn't hear it on Monday when it first went out. And I think that this is going to be really interesting because I'm sitting here, I guess, either with the luxury or not the luxury of knowing what is going to happen on November 3rd and November 4th for that matter. But I can sit here and speculate. But what we do know right now is that we have very serious issues with our election. And I'm not talking about, President Trump versus Vice President Biden and all that kind of stuff. As I've mentioned a million times, cybersecurity is agnostic to politics, even though we are oftentimes not immune from it, as actually my next radio show in a couple of weeks will show, because I've got a really interesting interview that I've also done. And so I say that to say that as I focus on the election here, I am not focusing on the politics of this, you know, which candidate is better or worse or whatever. Everybody's going to have their own opinion to that. I'm sure everybody listening to this does. But I want to talk about election security. That is my purview here. And that is what I do for a living, cybersecurity, election security, these kinds of things. And for the first time in 244 years, the integrity of the U.S. presidential election has been called into doubt. And I think the world is really going to see what a truly contentious looks like, contentious election looks like for a superpower. And so looking back over the last few years of election security standards improvement, or quite frankly, lack thereof, because there have been several bills that have been killed in the Senate for election security that simply did not make it through the Senate, we need to start understanding how the next election in 2022 and 2024 and beyond can be more secure. And so with that, I've actually written an article that will be out probably 2 to 4 weeks after the election or so when it goes through editing at Forbes and all of that. But it will be called 7 Security Lessons from the 2020 Election. And those are lessons that we have already learned right now, stemming from the last election and going into the one, which again, I don't know right now what is going to happen. But this is how we actually secure an election to increase voter confidence, but also voter security. And so by virtue of that, I'm just going to dive right into this, because the first lesson, lesson number one, is to secure voter registration databases. We got reports in the last couple of weeks that essentially 2 databases full of voter registration, basically people, you and I and all of that, got hit. And foreign governments were able to get access to this and then started sending messages, in this case, specifically people to Florida, threatening them if they chose to vote for Joe Biden. This was actual news. You may have missed it in just the cacophony of news, but we need to first secure voter registration databases. We need to do that with basically encrypting these databases and making sure that we have threat intelligence in front of them, like firewalls and antivirus and all of that. That will help give voters confidence that their data as being supplied to the U.S. government is more secure than it currently is. The second lesson, lesson number 2, is to ensure the physical and technical security of voting machines. Now, this is a twofold lesson, but both of these points are intertwined as it focuses on the voting machines themselves. Voting machine manufacturers have had a very long history of basically being called out for lax standards and practices in both the coding of the machines that allow the voters to cast their votes, meaning the software. So when you go up and you hit a touchscreen and say, I'm voting for candidate A or candidate B, that's the software, that's the coding in the machine, but as well as storing that vote safely. So that you know that when you cast your vote and the machine records it, it is saving it in a safe and secure manner. The other problem that we have is that these voting machines are integrating poor physical security, which makes them easier to tamper with. So there was a demonstration by a colleague of mine that basically went to a voting machine in under 2 minutes, something like 90 seconds, with a ballpoint pen, she was able to pop open the lock, slide out the data card, insert her own data card into it, and then reboot the voting machine and have it do basically whatever she wanted it to do. In under 2 minutes, she could have sat there looking like she was voting and essentially swapped out the card, which would have tampered with the machine, and that may not have been caught. And so to fix this, I believe that manufacturers need to build in tamper-resistant locks with audible intrusion alarms, meaning if somebody tries to pick the lock or it gets vibrated too hard as you're trying to break it, basically an alarm is going to sound on the machines. Further, the software that runs on each machine should adhere to standardized software a software development lifecycle that is essentially audited by independent cybersecurity personnel to ensure that the machine coding isn't altered. Meaning, if I am able to break in and tamper with this or swap out cards or anything along these lines, there should be a continuous lifecycle development as we have voting machine software 1.0 to 2.0 to 3.0, and it should be independently verified that the code isn't weak or easily exploitable. And I think that's something that is going to be very important. These independent reports by these security personnel should be made public, minus the actual source code of the machine or other proprietary information, because if I can obviously get the source code, then I would know how to alter it and try to attack it. But the certification from that third party should be made public, again, to give voters peace of mind. This is going to assure the electorate it's safe when it's using a voting machine. So we need to ensure the physical and technical security of our voting machines as well. That actually leads us to the third lesson, and that is the insurance, or to ensure that election judges cannot actually tamper with the election. When we are sitting here in a contentious election cycle with people drawing very hard lines on, you know, whatever candidate they support, love, or worship, depending on who you are, this can trickle into election judges. And so how do we ensure that election judges aren't just, able to tamper with this? Now, election judge, at least here in my home state of Illinois, they have to declare whether they are a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, whatever that is. I don't know how that is in all 50 states. But if we do things outside of the scope of a declaration, meaning I could be a hardcore Republican or Democrat, become an election judge and declare for the opposite party, and now I'm technically tampering. If I'm the one that's counting the votes, I could be throwing out the Democrat votes if I'm a Republican, or the Republican votes if I'm a Democrat. So what we need is simply this: change logs for any interaction with the voting machines by election judges needs to be independently created and securely stored where the judges cannot access them. Meaning, if I am an election judge and I decide to go to machine A and do some work on it, whether it's legitimate work like upgrading it, changing it, you know, whatever that is, or I'm doing something malicious like trying to tamper with it, that change log should basically be there that I cannot get to an audit. Meaning, let's say I break into the machine and try to change it illegally, there is some kind of change log that is now recorded that I don't have access to as an election judge. I don't have the logins, I can't get to this, which now shows me a proper chain of custody. This would help to ensure that no election judge can attempt to alter a voting machine. And when we pair this with video surveillance 24/7 of voting machines, it would be very, very hard for any partisan actor to basically, quote unquote, fix the vote. So as we monitor these things, we can see the election judge come in. And if the official log says, okay, Monday at 4 o'clock, you know, Nick is supposed to come in and upgrade the machine or whatever it is, and there I am at 4 in the morning doing this, and the video camera is catching me and it's not in the log, now we have a disparity. Now I get questioned. Now we can look at the machines that I have potentially touched per the video recording and the lack of change log. This is why we log and audit things in cybersecurity as well. It gives us a forensic paper trail to investigate when something goes wrong. We need to ensure election judges cannot tamper with the election. And that's lesson 3. There's 4 more to go. And let's continue with lesson 4. And that is to ensure the accuracy of a citizen's vote. This has obviously been a huge problem in my industry. When you have voting machines that can be easily tampered with, especially the touchscreen ones, there was a demonstration a few years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, where an 11-year-old kid in under 20 minutes broke into an election machine about, I want to say, 8-ish years ago or so. Another cybersecurity researcher live for a city council turned a voting machine into a Pac-Man machine where he could play Pac-Man on it. And so if these machines are very easily to be tampered with or altered, then we have to make sure that what we are doing or what the voter is voting for is actually accurate. And this is how I think we do this. Every voting machine in the United States should be required to produce a paper receipt for the voter once they have voted so they can review who their candidate selections are. So in other words, if I vote, let's say, for candidate A down the row, like I'm all for party A, I vote all for party A, I should have a paper receipt that I bring home, that I can take with me, that shows every single vote that I've done. This receipt should have a unique identifying code or number on it. And so if the election is called into dispute, let's say my county says, oh my God, you know, there was tampering and malfeasance and all of that, I can then show up as a voter, let's say to City Hall or wherever the dispute is, with my receipt and my unique ID that will be validated outside of the voting machine that this is a legitimate ballot. And now my votes can be recounted. And so I think that that is something that is beyond important, because in the age of electronics or anything else where, you know, the voting machine says, thanks, you voted for candidate A, and it secretly recorded it for candidate B, which is a possibility. This helps mitigate that if there is ever a hint of malfeasance. And I've said this before, I'm not necessarily worried about, you know, votes being changed in an election, you know, in this, let's say, by a foreign actor. Like, that would be a massive, just a massive project for them to come here, basically break into voting machines in strategic areas around the country and start altering or changing votes. But programming issues do happen. Or if these machines, God forbid, hit the internet and get updated, if somebody's able to crack into them, then they can reprogram them on the fly to say, okay, two votes for candidate A for every one vote of candidate B, and here we go. And we have seen examples of miscalculating votes or voting machines that had coding wrong, not malicious, simply a mistake. There was a county that had something like 5,000 registered votes on their voting machines, and it was a county of like 2,000 people, or a city of 2,000 people. It's crazy. And there wasn't any malfeasance. It was, oh, my bad, I'm sorry, we put a decimal place in the wrong place when we created the voting machine, and here we are, or on the update, or whatever that was. So these are designed not just to secure the election, but again, give everybody peace of mind. Which brings us to lesson number 5. State-issued identification should be required for all votes, no exceptions. Now, before you sit here and scream at me being like, oh my God, the whole voter ID thing, Nick, oh, this is, you know, this was a whole thing. This was a political football and all of that. I am 100% aware. And this is why, why we should have it. I think we should have voter ID universally, but this is how we fix this from being a political football. States should be forced or required to create a set aside in their budgets for these ID cards, which would be 100% free to every citizen in the state. This budget would also include the personnel from the state needed to visit any citizen who is unable for whatever reason to appear at one of the many state facilities, let's say DMVs, across the state, but they have requested identification. So maybe they're infirmed. Maybe they are rural and don't have a car, you know, whatever that is. We have to basically give everybody a state ID. It has to be free. And then the state will go to you if you request it. This way, nobody can then say that they are disenfranchised from voting, given all of the available opportunities to get an official identification. There has been, and I will state this, next to no evidence, almost zero, of widespread voting by non-citizens. And so, by virtue of that, and everybody having an ID for free, this should take this issue off the table in terms of politics. Because now you have to show your state ID. It has been issued. You have been validated. It is free to you. It will continue to be free to you because there's a set aside in the state budget, all 50 states. There is no excuse now not to have this. And that will take that off the table 100% completely, so that nobody can say the election is rigged. Nobody can say that, oh, well, the, you know, 3 million illegals have voted this election or whatever this is. This fixes that issue for good. And it helps citizens with something that they need, which is identification, because you can't live in a society without really getting identification. And so that is lesson 5, and I think that's beyond important. Lesson 6, I think we have learned in 2020, which is something I did not even contemplate until I started seeing it in the news, and that is the integrity of the post office needs to be reinforced. Isolation from federal control during national elections is of paramount importance to maintaining the integrity of the U.S. Postal Service. The highest priority for safeguarding and delivery of ballots to their destinations should be enforced under the threat of possible termination or criminal charges for any postal worker found to be willing to interfere with the process of delivering ballots. Meaning, if a postal worker decides, I'm just going to take this basket of ballots and throw it in the garbage or whatever it is, if that is found and it is malicious, that is prosecutable. Further, the Postmaster General should also be hired via internal promotion from within the United States Postal Service. And at any time, should this ever, this person should never be a political appointee, that is allowed to hold the position. We have seen that this year. Now, during an election, the United States Postal Service should also have a third-party independent commission appointed to oversee it, which will ensure that the focus of the budget for the United States Postal Service is on the election during the time period. In this case, we'd be in that time period, as well as any, and this is important, any operational changes during the election, meaning the independent oversight ensures that there will be no changes to the to the inner workings, to the procedures of the United States Postal Service that could be made for political purposes or other reasons. We saw some massive sorting machines get spun down in the last couple of months in the U.S. Postal Service. And obviously they're claiming, okay, this is our new logistics. This is everything. That may be true. It may be for political purposes to slow the mail down. You believe what you want to believe. The point is that this lesson that I am talking about, having this in place mitigates that, because it would be illegal to make operational changes to the post office in an election season. And I am talking about, let's say, the last 6 months of the election. It doesn't have to be, obviously, or maybe the full year. So in 2019, you can make changes to the post office, but in 2020, you can't. Same with 2021. Can't do anything. 2022, you can't. 23, and on and on and on. So this is what I'm seeing. Also, under this guise, any citizen who chooses to impersonate the United States Postal Service, whether it be a person, whether it be in person or by deploying things like fake mailbox or fake ballot boxes, which we have seen a rash of in Southern California. There have been multiple news articles about that the Southern California GOP was starting to put out ballot boxes of saying official ballot box, and it was not. It was not USPS. It was their ballot box, that they should be held criminally liable and prosecuted. A free and open election is exactly that. You have to have everybody that is a citizen that is eligible to vote. They have to have that right. If there is any malfeasance or any impediment to them being able to vote, whether it's voter intimidation, whether it's a fake ballot box where they've just turned over, they unknowingly turned over their ballot to an organization that will destroy it, that should be illegal. That should have jail time. That is disgusting. I don't care who does it. This is a nonpartisan issue. Anything like this on either side should be met with the law to the fullest extent possible. Otherwise, we are going to continue to disenfranchise voters. People will continue to lose faith. Understand that part of cybersecurity is also security theater. And we have to understand when security theater, meaning when you have the illusion of security but not real security, is important, versus when you need actual security and how to balance those two. And so all of these things on the books, with, let's say, aggressive attorney generals in each state that will prosecute this regardless of political affiliation, goes just, it's light years worth of confidence in voting right now when we have an election. And again, I am recording this the day before, or broadcasting rather, the day before the election. This becomes beyond important. And finally, the last lesson, and I think this is one of the most important because it is just affecting everybody. Lesson number 7, voter education and disinformation awareness training should be required in order to vote. Any candidate for federal office, I don't care if you're the president of the United States or the federally appointed dog catcher, regardless of your party. So if you're Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Green, silly party, whatever you are, you should be required to formally state your positions on major national issues such as taxes, capital punishment, foreign policy, abortion, gun control, on and on and on, to an independent nonpartisan website. Candidates who fail to submit their positions should be rendered ineligible. So in other words, let's say you declare your candidacy in 2018, you should be, or rather 2019, excuse me, by, let's say, January 1st of 2020, you should have your positions out there on the major agreed upon positions so that voters can see this. And the voting population of the United States should be required to take educational classes that lay out the candidates' beliefs
on just basically how to spot, and also they lay out the candidate's beliefs, but also on how to spot and disregard disinformation. Given the tendency to support news stories, whether they're real or fake, that support a person's confirmation bias, this will hopefully start to turn the tide for a good percentage of the population that simply believes fake news. For many, skepticism ends where political bias begins. This is a completely untenable position for any nation in the long term. Now, this education can be done online or in person, but it is required. We can register it through that state ID. I will say this, though. A test at the end of this should not be required due to possible concerns of disenfranchisement. So think of like the old Jim Crow poll taxes and literacy tests and all of that. You should have to sit through education so that you understand Vice President Biden believes this, President Trump believes that. But you shouldn't have a test or quiz on it. There are going to be people inevitably that are going to sit through this and be like, oh my God, one candidate's amazing, the other's a monster, whatever that is. Or you're going to get people that say, yes, 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 click, click, click. I know what I believe. But this is going to be eye-opening for a good chunk of people because basically what you're being taught are the own words of the candidate. Vice President Biden believes X on this subject, and his quote from the website is this. President Trump believes X because his quote from the website is this. These are the things that we need to do to start changing this tide of misinformation and disinformation. You may actually see one candidate or the other, not so much as a monster, maybe somebody that means well, but simply disagrees with you. And that is a much better position. You're not going to vote for the guy, but that might be a better position than thinking everybody is awful.
And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.